The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs, we don't
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast.
Virgil Texas and Matt Chrisman are two of the five co-hosts from the hugely popular leftist podcast, Chapo Trap House, and they stopped by the Zero Books podcast this week to discuss their new book, The Chapo Guide to Revolution. It's Wednesday, September 5th, 2018, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. The music you're listening to is DJ Smokey's Salute to El Chapo. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to Virgil and Matt discuss libtards, logic, and revolution. Virgil Texas and Matt Chrisman are two of the five co-hosts. Is it five over there at Chapo Trap House? It's a socialist podcast funded through Patreon by tens of thousands of George Soros' sock puppets. They arose to become massively popular after the 2016 election, and they helped to undermine Western culture every week. With the publication of their book, The Chapo Trap House Guide to Revolution, they're helping to undermine it through the written word as well. Virgil and Matt, welcome to the Zero Books podcast.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah. Thank you.
So in preparation for this conversation, I did two things. I'm a little bit older than you guys, so I went ahead and got a hold of a vocabulary list, a lexicon of today's millennial vernacular.
Oh, yes.
I want to be able to communicate with you guys, speak your language. On the other hand, in order to hold you to account and to appease a small group of wayward proto-incels that listen to my podcast, I have also printed up a list of logical fallacies that I'll be referring to periodically. So not going to let you guys off the hook.
Look forward to sparring with you.
Anyway, I'm very glad that we'll be able to swing on the flippity-flop together today.
Epic. Simply epic.
How old is the typical Chapo listener, do you think? Do you have the demographics on that?
If we were more professional, we probably could get that information. From informal sources, my estimate is early 20s.
I think the median age is... I think it's 24, actually.
That sounds about right.
Somewhere between 24 and 26.
Yeah, college graduates and college students and recent grads, I'd say, is the bulk.
Okay.
And we're, and that's younger than all of us.
Oh, yes.
Right, I know. You guys are, what, late 20s, early 30s?
Mm-hmm. Most of us are in our 30s. Felix is the youngest one, and he's in his late 20s. We're authority figures to them.
Yeah, we're daddy.
Yeah.
Matt is an adult. Matt is a literal adult to them.
I mean, not in any like, meaningful sense of my life. I'm a giant child and dressed like one.
Yes.
But compared to these kids, yes, I am their father, or at least a unstable uncle.
We're the man.
The reason I brought it up is because I noticed that you assume that the typical Chapo fan has boomer parents. But I'm in my late 40s, and I had boomer parents. I'm ancient. And my oldest kids are 20 and 21 years old. And they talk about strange things that I don't understand, like One Piece and Snapchat and attending classes. In future books, maybe talk about Gen X a little more is what I'm saying.
Well, there's a period, right, between Gen X and boomers that's still a very large cohort, and you don't really know how to categorize them. Like Barack Obama, do you call him a Gen Xer or a boomer?
Oh, Gen Xer.
It's less about them, their parents, really, than just sort of identifying the people who are most responsible, really, for the given situation we're in. And I think that is like the boomers and their stranglehold on the economy and culture, even more so, is sort of a constant topic for poking fun for us.
Right.
And it is, it's one of, boomers are the most politically influential generation in our society, most responsible for defining the terms of the debate today, essentially the world that people of our generation have inherited. And they are, you know, white boomers are a fairly monolithic voting bloc.
If you, yes, they are deeply reactionary and have they're just basically been a giant anchor around our necks.
And comparing, you know, the voting bloc of white boomers and their beliefs generally with the voting bloc of millennials, and especially, like, just under 29, it's night and day.
Yeah, do you think that's just because the boomers got old? I mean, do you think that, you know, in 30 years, this generation is going to be the same way?
It's a few things. I mean, yeah, they did get old, but also, I mean... And I'm probably not the best person to opine about this, but I would think that, some of my co-authors would argue that the new left radicalism of the boomer generation of the 60s was a failure from the start. It was built on this shaky foundation that would inevitably lead to, accommodation with the economic status quo.
I mean, they were the last generation of Americans to benefit from that freakish sort of great contraction, the great economic contraction of the post-war era, when the bounty of America's industrial might as sort of the sole producing great power after the war was relatively broadly shared, basically for the first time in American history. And as a result, they're clinging to the last bits of that, the home ownership and the pensions, and they have nothing but contempt for generations younger than them who they take to be entitled and lazy, when in fact they are the most entitled people in essentially the history of the planet. and it's that particular noxious sort of ideology, and I think that's why we don't have to worry as much about young people today having that happen, because they don't have the cushion of comfort that the boomers did that allowed them to become so nauseatingly complacent as soon as they got bored with playing dress up and pretending to be revolutionaries.
The backwater of Europe to a major imperialist power, which is able to grant concessions to the working class, such as rising wages and a social safety net. The party's orientation towards reforms resulted in a change in the composition of the SPD, with the entrance of non-proletarian elements, the growth of the bureaucracy and officialdom, who were cut off from the masses. All of this encouraged the tendencies towards conservatism and nationalism within the party. Yet this produced in the SPD a need to square their seemingly revolutionary theory with a reformist practice that led to the controversy between revisionism and orthodoxy. For revisionists such as Edward Bernstein, the problem was simple enough. They wanted to update Marxism by officially turning the party into a social reform group that would bring theory into line with what they were actually doing. Ironically, Hooke says the revisionists were honest and consistent. By contrast, their orthodox opponents were dishonest for acting one way, always with the revisionists, and speaking in another, always against the revisionists. Orthodox Marxists such as Karl Kautsky argued that orthodoxy was the correct interpretation of Marxism, yet this was a very peculiar form of Marxism, which was not viewed as the theory and practice of revolution, but as the science of social development. For Orthodox Marxists, socialism came about inevitably due to the processes at work under capitalism. In other words, this was a passive and fatalistic Marxism that was divorced from revolutionary practice. Hooke said that this Marxism could analyze both the past and predict the future, but it was of no use in the present. Rather, it was a religion of consolation that dominated both the SPD and the Second International. Despite their verbal commitment to revolution, Orthodox Marxists were similar in practice to the revisionists. For both revisionists and Orthodox social democrats, there was a divorce between means and ends, which emasculated and bastardized Marxism. Rather, Hooke said, those who preserved Marxism were Rosa Luxemburg and Lenin. They had argued for a connection between the means and the ends, linking everyday struggles of workers with the conquest of power, which was the ultimate aim of the socialist movement.
In 2008, my whole perspective on how to be a leftist changed because of the economic crisis. I was probably one of the, I'm a Gen Xer, but I was probably kind of playing dress up as a, some sort of anarchist type before then, you know, reading Adbusters and shit like that.
Epic.
Yeah. And then the economic crisis came around and I realized that I didn't really understand the forces that were shaping the world very well. And I started this podcast, actually, or a version of it. It was called something else, but I interviewed a lot of Marxists and different economists. And the conclusion I came to was that the reason the New Deal was possible and the Great Society after was possible was because we had a boom after World War II, and that it was rather short-lived, and really since the 70s we've been in a slump, reoccurring recessions.
The New Deal was made necessary by a very radical labor movement that was honestly threatening the stability of the American of capitalism. And the New Deal was essentially the liberal half of the ruling class making an accommodation with a force that was an actual threat to them. But then the Great Society sort of boom time that we think of is entirely a product of the fact that profits were so astronomical for American industry because the United States was the sole center of industrial production after World War II in the world, that they were able to trade profits for stability, essentially. They traded percentages of the profits of the company for a stable labor situation. And more importantly than anything, they also were willing to trade that money to keep control over the production process, because that was the red line that even in the golden era of labor peace and at the height of America's labor movement, that the capital never conceded, which was workplace control. And they were willing to barter more money for workers if it meant they maintained control of the production process, which meant that when competition started to appear from other countries and when the profit rate started to shrink, that they were able to once again dictate terms and move production to different places where labor was cheaper and essentially undermine labor's negotiating position and essentially just deal with the falling rate of profit by just cannibalizing the share of labor income.
Do you think that the New Deal and that kind of social spending and military spending was what got us out of the Great Depression?
It was the full employment economics of the war economy. And,
yes.
And the thing is that the bad part of that, the really – because, I mean, it was something that could have been possible, honestly, without that. But there was no political will and there was no political imagination for it. Like even guys like FDR were deeply uncomfortable with really heavy amounts of social spending from the government.
Mm-hmm.
That's why in 1936, after a massive fucking re-election, the greatest in American history – FDR still pulled back from the New Deal and led to a fucking recession because they were just uncomfortable with that level of spending. It was only the seeming necessity of a military buildup that allowed them to justify to themselves and to the capitalist class in general this level of government spending. And what that did after the war is create a model where the only Keynesianism that would have support politically and among economic elites was military Keynesianism. And that's the economy we created after World War II on the back of military spending, especially once we got into Vietnam. And that helped undermine the stability of all these social programs that were also part of it, because it was never built on an endogenous economy that sort of saw to needs and things like that. It really was about building stuff that was only useful to the degree to which it was destroyed in war and then rebuilt.
And as well, emerging from the war as the undisputed hegemon of global capitalism meant that the spoils from the war could actually trickle down and build a relatively sturdy middle class in this country.
Right, because, again, because the rate of profit was high and the the Depression had been overcome, and so the Keynesian approach could succeed for a time. Mm-hmm. But the one thing I noticed is that there's kind of two different interpretations or answers as to why the Great Depression lasted as long as it did and why we were able to overcome it. And you gave one answer, which is that it was social spending and the military buildup that rebooted the economy and got things to be productive and profitable again. The other answer that I tend to go with is that it was the destruction of capital during the war that allowed for reinvestment on the cheap and rebooted the rate of profit that way. So it was actually the depth of the Depression itself, and including the physical destruction of capital, but also just the destruction of the value.
Yeah, well, I mean, those aren't mutually exclusive.
No, I guess not, but I think it matters a little bit, because if you think that social spending played a huge role, then a Keynesian approach to solving capitalism's contradictions might be more appealing.
But the New Deal didn't solve capitalism's contradictions. It was always designed to be what essentially a half measure.
Yeah. And the thing is that the money's not there now. Period. The money, the profits that allowed for the sort of stable Keynesian consensus there, that doesn't exist anymore. And as a result, any kind of economic agenda is going to have to involve massive redistribution. The idea, and not the idea that you can just prime the pump or anything like that. I mean, the money is so concentrated at this point, and firms are operating on such narrow fucking margins that you can't just move the columns around that way anymore. It's going to have to be a wholesale reorientation of the economy in order to address needs rather than just allow money to accumulate at the very top and then hope that some of it spills over.
Yeah, no matter what, I mean, what we have to do is eliminate the profit motive, and that, or rather the profit motive that governs our distributions and decisions in a society.
Well, let's talk about we could debate the, you know, fine points of this for a while, but rather than do that, I want to give you an opportunity to turn back to the profit motive and talk about your book. Why did you choose to write a book? Your podcast is tremendously successful. I think you're making Jordan Peterson money. Did you?
Well, I'll give you the answer. Why did Michael Jordan decide to play baseball? Same reason we wrote a book: gambling debts.
Virgil sort of was the first to reach out and see about the possibility, when people presented an option to us, I mean, I hadn't really thought of it, but I think the idea of expressing ourselves in a more long-form way and able to do things that you can't do on the show, like we have these great drawings by Ellie Valley, we've got a kids section, we've got and we have longer disquisitions on things where we were all able to sort of collaborate and bring together like a syncretic point of view that really the podcast just it's a degree of in-depth focus on issues and certain types of jokes that you just really can't do in a podcast form.
Yeah, so I had just joined the show in November of 2016, right after the election, and at that point I had been working on a pitch for a book with my co-host Felix. And that pitch didn't really go anywhere, but the agent was interested when I kind of on the fly brought up Chapo Trap House, which was starting to become a phenomenon right then. And, you know, I brought that to everyone else and we sat in for a couple of meetings and we decided to go out and, you know, pull the trigger and pitch the book.
Well, did you think that you might be reaching out to people who didn't listen to your podcast with the book? Is that part of the reason, because actually, I before I got on the line with you, I asked people who listen to Zero Books, some of the patrons, what they would ask you. And of course, they're all fans and listen to your show. And they asked if you were writing a book to reach past your usual audience and to find normies who might not have heard of you.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, I have to say that, like, the honest, if I found out about that this happened, if I found, if someone told me that they didn't listen to the show, maybe didn't even know who we were, and they came across the book in a bookstore or something or at someone's house and looked through it and found it interesting and then read it and then had it influence them in some way, I would feel very, very pleased and rewarded for that, because that's the kind of thing that I remember as a kid. Like, that was what shaped my worldview, is stumbling across books,
yes,
that I didn't even know what was going to be in them. And then just the experience of reading them and being confronted with a new perspective on something just totally changed the way I thought about something. And then just the excitement that you feel after that. And if that happens to any kid, young people, I'd be very, very pleased.
Yeah, same here. I echo that 100%. We wrote the book with a broad audience in mind. That's why we didn't write, you know, a Chapo show companion or something like that, or just like table of all the inside jokes from the fucking podcast. No, it's all fresh material. And what's actually interesting to me, I was thinking about this the other night, that, you know, we've articulated a sort of mythos on the show, and that mythos has not really incorporated any of the new ideas from the book. And to a lesser extent, vice versa.
Am I right in thinking that Chapo became as big as it did after Trump was elected?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, you can go back. There's charts and graphs of this information. But it was, much like the DSA, it was right after Trump's election that the thing really, really exploded.
Yeah, I think people who at that point maybe were still clinging to all the bromides from establishment Democrats about the need for supporting the pragmatic, you know, maybe not inspiring, but realistic wing of the Democratic Party, that entire worldview is just destroyed. Because if you're not able to beat the orange carnival barker, oaf, moron, Donald Trump, the joke of a human, the guy who literally was going to be the fucking president in a Sharknado movie a year before he ran, you can't beat him, then your project is doomed and a failure. And I think that people had that realization and started flocking to anybody who was making the point, making the case already that was a failed model.
And the show was successful before then, but it was still basically kind of like a niche online thing. And I would guess that the reason why so many people decided to subscribe and essentially give this vote of confidence after the election of Trump, where they had not done so previously, was because I think people were still kind of on the fence about this thing and just kind of, you know, hoping or praying that, you know, Hillary Clinton could drag herself over the finish line and all the demons would be, you know, kept at bay and we would, you know, we would survive for another 4 years. And when that fantasy imploded, people, I think, started casting around and they looked at the voice of, and this was, you know, before I was on the show, this was just Will, Matt, and Felix. They gave a serious look to the voices of the people who were totally unfettered and had no, you know, no vague responsibility that all the liberals in the media have to soft walk Hillary Clinton, who spent the summer not holding back and articulating exactly what her campaign represents and why it was more or less doomed.
I remember the podcast you guys did right after the election, and it was like, it saved my life.
Well, oh my, Secretary Clinton has come into the room. Hold on, I'm going to give my mic to Secretary Clinton. Secretary Clinton, what do you have to say after Tuesday's offense? I may not be David Carradine, but I fucking choke. I may not be Johnny Knoxville, but I ate shit on live TV. I said, I may not be Dale Earnhardt, but I smashed into the fucking wall because I couldn't turn left.
Right. Well, it was because this entire neoliberal managerial project had utterly failed. And I mean, I Matt can answer this, but I assume my co-hosts during 2016 were quite aware that this foundation had been crumbling for some time. Specifically, you know, you look at the loss of state houses and Congress, congressional seats and governorships under the Obama administration, which, I mean, if you're like a Neera Tanden type, you could say, oh, well, that's just midterm loss. That just happens. But it genuinely now in retrospect feels like it was the country lurching to the right, at least the voters of the country lurching to the right, and everyone else just sort of feeling disenfranchised.
Right. And that was a big story of the election, I think, was how many people didn't bother to vote, especially working class people.
Yeah, that is amazing, especially when you look at how, if you look at Hillary Clinton with, you know, rose colored glasses and you just see a decent politician or something like that, you would be shocked that anyone would pass up the opportunity to vote for her. And specifically vote against her grotesque opponent and the hatred that he represents. But apparently the vast majority of the people in this country were appalled by both options. And, you know, the Clinton campaign was, as we know now, quite aware of how unpopular she was. And they got sick of reporters asking about it. So they just stopped answering the question and they stopped trying to do anything about it. And they figured, oh, well, you know, at least she's normal. She's a politician. She seems like someone who would be president. He's not. So there's no way anyone can vote for him.
That's what they ran on, and it didn't work.
No, because people don't like politicians. People are terribly alienated from the politics that we have now.
There was a fundamental assumption, and I got to admit that I shared it to a degree. The American voters had this idea of what was proper in an elected official. And that their sense of that would make it basically impossible for any kind of meaningful number of them in the important states to vote for Donald Trump, this grotesque parody of a presidential candidate. And it turns out, no. It turns out all those years of just politicians failing utterly to address anybody's real day-to-day concerns of sort of just blithely presiding over this neoliberal hollowing out of America, it meant that they actually weren't committed to any of those ideas of propriety and were willing to give a chance to Trump, or more of them didn't even feel the need to show up.
There's a line in your book that I think summarizes or kind of gives us a peek into the mentality that was so pervasive in the Clinton campaign. But it has nothing to do with the Clinton campaign particularly, or it's not aimed at her or that campaign. But it's this line, the petite bourgeois, in order to differentiate themselves from the gentry who entertain themselves with bum fights, racism, orgies, and pederasty, invented the dullest culture possible. They started eating curiously wet cheeses, seeing plays to make sure they were bad, and babbling endlessly about university wait lists. And it was so accurate. I wanted to ask if you are all, you know, if your guys are from the petty bourgeois class yourself, or if you've just done a lot of legwork or field work.
Not where Felix are.
Yeah, Matt and I and Amber are not.
Yeah, I guess I was what? Middle or lower middle class.
Yeah.
Amber was like working class. Virgil was, of course, famously private, but I know he was not.
I was what you'd call lower middle class to the extent that that means anything.
Yeah.
I would probably have to say it's a working class upbringing. Yeah.
Yeah, I think Felix wrote that. That sounds like Felix. The thing about weirdly wet cheeses, that's a Felix. Felix classic.
Making fun of the affectations of the people he grew up around. Yeah. That's very Felix.
I worked in the nonprofit industry for a long time, and I had bosses that were exactly like Hillary Clinton in a variety of different places. And they were all this sort of suburban bourgeois types. So
that's really it about the election. Both of the candidates reminded you of a shitty boss you've had, just a total sneering asshole who genuinely doesn't care about your well-being. I mean, I remember in the debates when Hillary Clinton would excoriate Trump's business record and say, you know, oh, he doesn't pay the people he works for, who work for him. He didn't pay his architects. I remember that was one of her fucking winning lines there. And the people who are the biggest boosters of her campaign, and frankly, she herself, couldn't fathom that they also represent a boss that you don't like. Oh, sure, they're probably more competent, and they probably pretend to show affection for you. But at the end of the day, if you try to form a union, they're just going to can your ass.
Right. And actually, you know, if you take that perspective, if you think of the president as your boss, who would you rather have, Trump or Clinton? And I think Trump, maybe, because he's an idiot.
So, yes, he's an idiot. You can get one over on him.
I mean, and all you got to do is just say his tie looks good, and he's going to let you get away with
that. And, you know, that one maybe has the best opportunity for advancement, because you look at the White House. He's created a miniature Game of Thrones there with all these fucking people conniving and leaking against each other.
That's right.
And also important is that, I mean, he literally was people's boss in their mind when they watched The Apprentice for 15 years. I mean, he was in their homes every week in this position as a serious and successful business magnate. And, like, that's what people carry around in their heads is those archetypes that they get from exposure to the programming that they like to watch as opposed to...
And at the end of the day, if you work a job that you hate, it just immiserates you totally, what's the one thing you want? You want to show up one day and your fucking factory or your Sears or wherever you work is burned down. And which boss seems more likely to burn it down? It's Donald Trump.
What do you guys think about the DSA these days? Are you guys pretty hot on it still? Or
We've learned to kind of keep a hands off for any org because we are controversial and there's a lot of internal politics in these organizations, and it's very easy for one faction or another to sort of use us as a wedge to try to get one over on other people within the organization. So
yeah.
we wish them very well, but we make it a kind of a policy to not get involved in any of their internal debate.
Well, as a show, anyway.
Yeah, right. I mean, we might do stuff individually, but we really don't want to speak like as the show on any of those issues.
Yeah, because then we're turning the show into a deliberation of internal politics that we only understand a fraction of, which would obviously just be a tremendous waste of time for everyone involved. I mean, I would say personally, I'm extremely heartened by the growth of the organization, and I hope that this continues, and I hope that the organization can, I mean, break out. We're still waiting on like a day. You know, there have been events like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's victory, and then, you know, all the media discussion regarding why young people like socialism, and is this the socialist moment, and all that stuff. But there has to be something more. This is still a latent thing. We know that millennials support socialism. We now know a majority of Democrats support socialism over capitalism. And so we know that opinions are changing, perceptions are changing. What has to happen is, and the DSA has by far the best opportunity to do this, is we have to put some meat on the bones and articulate an organizing model that can accommodate millions of people. And currently there are millions of people who are sympathetic to the organization, might be familiar with its existence, but aren't really ready to get involved with it. And, you know, I think the DSA, I mean, I think, well, generally everyone who's concerned with this matter should think about answering the question of what it means to be a socialist. And we live in a time when your political belief is relevant. It doesn't fucking matter. I go online and, I go online, to get abused by thousands of strangers every day. And many of them call themselves, I'm a Maoist and you're a revisionist, or I see a lot of people calling themselves Juche-ist. And it's like, that's cute, that's nice, that's meaningless. Who fucking cares?
Yeah, it's just posting styles. Because leftist politics in America is so divorced from grassroots and from any effective, interaction with mechanisms of power or workplace, that it's really just a way to express an individual identity online. And so a lot of these hyper distinctions boil down to posting styles and meme preferences. And like the task really before people who really want to affect this stuff is building mass orgs, building mass movements of because that's the only weapon we have, is the numbers. That's always been the only weapon that socialism has had, is pure numbers, because every other element of culture and politics and economics and technology are all arrayed on the side of capital. The only good news is that there's way more of us than there are of them, but we have to all be on the same page, relatively speaking.
Being on the same page is a tricky thing. If you've been a part of the Marxist left, it seems like it's impossible. I mean, I've been through a couple of sectarian groups. I can tell you it's getting some agreement about these things is not easy. So in that spirit, let me ask you this question about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. I recently saw the list of her policy proposals. It was, I think, flashed on the screen for Fox News, and someone captured it and then passed it around on Facebook. I looked at the list and I thought, well, that it was a very solid kind of left liberal list. Like it did not seem very far away from the Great Society. It didn't seem very far away from the kind of proposals that a Denis Kucinich might have made, or Ralph Nader might put forward.
Or Ro Khanna, or someone who's already in Congress.
Right. And so it was not socialist, if by socialist you mean something other than the New Deal or the Great Society. If you mean something other than an expansion of the welfare state and some better labor laws and job guarantees and things like that.
Right.
On the one hand, your book starts with some critiques of the libs and LBJ, but on the other hand, the radical politics, because of the state of the left, maybe, that we can aim at is precisely that.
Yeah. I mean, well, that's really the thing. It's easy to forget how far to the right this country has lurched since the Great Society, and how utterly destroyed all left power is right now. Just what a blasted landscape we live in. So if, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's platform, which I would agree with that assessment generally, if that is if that's insufficiently socialist, if the farthest left of the Overton window right now is just a return to the Great Society New Deal type politics, I don't really consider that a knock on her, because I would say if we're drawing that distinction between the Great Society and what we would call socialism, as, generally defined as the ownership of the means of production by the productive class, and the elimination, ideally, of the bourgeois class in a classless society, I would say we would stand a better chance of building the mass movement necessary to get to that point. If we had a, if something like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's platform were in effect.
Yeah, any leftist whose analysis of tactical and strategic questions doesn't begin with the premise that the left is essentially non-existent in this country right now isn't serious. That is the reality that everybody has to face first and foremost. And I think it's been pointed out by others that there is a qualitative difference between advocating for the things that Ocasio-Cortez is advocating for in, say, 1948 and now. The big difference being a massive, mobilized, effective labor movement. When that was the case, that was liberalism because it was the alternative to a genuine threat of socialism. Now, when we have two parties, one of which is by any metric a right-wing neoliberal party and then a outright fascist party and no left-wing mass party in the United States, then a return to the New Deal or the Great Society in the absence of political party that advocates for those positions or a mass base that's been mobilized around those positions or any kind of workplace power by the average American worker, that is more radical. And it is the thing that gets people involved because the task, the number one task right now above all others, and has to come before figuring out your which sect you're in or figuring out, which FOCO you're going to join, is getting people on board, getting massive numbers of people. I mean, DSA is the largest socialist organization in this country, and it has about 50,000 members in a country, 320 million people. That's just not viable. That's not going to move the needle.
Yeah.
Point, end of story. We need a situation where something like DSA or a different organization that comes out of it, who knows, is in the hundreds of thousands and millions of dues-paying members.
Yes.
That before we can even talk about making meaningful strides. So in this nascent state, the question is, what is going to engage people? And appealing to them on the idea of a system that was worked for more people and with more and provided more stability and more life chances, that's a good starting place. I mean, the danger of it being co-opted and turned into sort of a status quo enabling, that's very real. But I honestly don't see an alternative strategy in the given moment.
And I want to use this opportunity to address one piece of criticism that I keep seeing about the book for people who ostensibly enjoyed the book. And let me preface this by saying you should absolutely never criticize the book. That is revisionist and anti-dialectical.
I agree.
People say, the book's funny and I actually learned some stuff I didn't really know in it, but there weren't any solutions in the book. You did a good job of describing our current state of affairs and how we got there, but I wish you would have given us like a blueprint for how to get out of it. And that's staggering to me because the thing is, we don't know how to solve this intractable problem that we're articulating, a problem that some of our best minds have been working on for a long time and have not fucking figured out. The fact is, if there is an answer or a program, it's not going to come from us. It's not going to come from any fucking op-ed writer or celebrity that you like. It's going to come through consensus of the people working in organizations like the DSA to experiment and argue and hopefully figure out a way forward.
Yeah, I mean, because the left has been so powerless, people really think of left strategy in terms of I'm going to sit down with my friends and write out a plan, and then we're going to do it. And that's because there's no their praxis has no grip on the road because nobody has any real influence right now.
Okay, so now I have a question that's a little adversarial. Your book is a manifesto against logic, facts, and reason.
Yes.
To what extent do you think that people are going to be able to build a better system, new networks of relations and a new politics when they are not able to, turn to rationality and have that kind of dispassionate stance towards their circumstances?
the title is mostly a joke.
I know, but
actually, and the book does not. The book has arguments in it that, you know, use logic, facts, and reason to bolster that.
There's also a lot of ad homs in it.
Oh yeah, I forgot to go through. I was supposed to call you guys out on all your logical fallacies, and I forgot to do it.
Well, that's because we haven't made any, Doug.
But mostly, it's a reaction to this fetish on the right. This idea that right has claimed the concepts of rationality and facts, and that they own them, and that the left basically is just an emotive series of whiny cries, and it doesn't have any kind of rational basis to it. And that is just an absurdity, and we just didn't want to play that game. We wanted to make a direct challenge to that. That perception and that pretension of that. But yeah, I mean, you need those things. You cannot attempt to elevate them to godhood and imagine that you claim sole possession.
As well, it's not just the right. I mean, I'm sure you saw the, this review that Bill Sheridan
blew. Yeah, I was going to mention them. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, and the reaction of, like, basically just everyone we've roasted on the show was like, oh, they really got him here. It's the thing is, that title is also a reaction to them, this centrists and liberals and conservatives who are the wonks. They're the responsible people who are just writing out blueprints for ideal policies using all the facts and all the logic, because they fundamentally have this conception of politics as like it's a big science fair, and whoever writes the most logical proposal will get the get a blue ribbon, and that's going to be what's adopted by Washington. That's inane. And they objected to this idea that we would write this book where we are opposed to the conditions of work today, and we're opposed to capitalism. And they would say, you haven't explained how to do this.
And also they just neglect the idea that politics is about telling a convincing story. It's not about arraying a bunch of statistics or thrilling them with the fun possibilities of navigating the Obamacare exchange website.
Oh,
it's
God.
About telling a compelling story to people, because people, for the most part, aren't analyzing things at that granular level. They have their life concerns. They know what's bad in their lives. And the question is, who's going to explain to them in the most compelling way what's the fault, what's the cause of it, and what's the solution for it? And that is... It involves logic, facts, and reason, but it is not exclusively those things. There's also the role for narrative and passion and morality and these things that the centrist wonks and the right wing are actively contemptuous of.
And I'll say this about the centrists and liberals who genuinely believe that they agree with us on most things. Except that their reasons for believing these things are due to logic and evidence. And since the start of the show, even before I joined it, I would say we've been opposed to this idea, this fantasy, that everyone in this country stands on equal footing and that we all have we're all just a big community. We're like Athenian democracy or a New England town hall where everyone in the country just sort of gets together and evaluates plans and we just decide on the most reasonable proposals. Obviously that's moronic, and the victory of Donald Trump, I mean, should have been the nail in that coffin. But today, liberals still fantasize that they're going to fact-check their way out of this current crisis, and that once they get all the facts in, once they see how superior the Democrats' proposals are, they'll have no choice but to concede their own fallacies and pull the lever for their the local CIA agent running for Congress as a Democrat.
Right. Well, I watched the guy that wrote the scathing review of your book every once in a while on YouTube. He's got he's part of Blogging Heads TV, and that's a channel that's just filled up with wonks, the people from The Atlantic or the New York Times.
I've heard of that's the most popular website in existence.
It's not.
Yeah, that thing, like, everyone's talking about it. All the young people love Blogging Heads.
You know, you're talking about how they really want to, take down the conservatives first and foremost. I'm not so sure about that, because they have their most energy into criticizing liberals. And they go beyond the standard Obama's a neoliberal corporatist and Bill Clinton's neoliberal corporatist. They're criticizing the Great Society. They're criticizing the New Deal. They go as far as the seeds of liberalism's failure are in the New Deal, because the New Deal failed to destroy capitalism. It only tried to manage capitalism and maintain the racial caste system. There are elements to truth in that.
Well, I've watched it a lot because I'm not a young person. And one of the things that always frustrates me, it's not their reliance on facts and reason and logic and argumentation or the civilized kind of debate that goes on there. It's the fact that they're so constrained in what they can be reasonable about.
But here's the thing. At the root of it is a moral question, not a factual question or a logical question, a moral question of whether capitalism as currently constituted is or can be a moral state of affairs. Otherwise, it's a material question. I'm of the class of people with a cushy job or lives off the labor of others, so of course I support it. And I'm of the class of people who is having his or her productive forces exploited, so I should ostensibly oppose it, though that's obviously not the case much of the time.
I think the liberal people who get on Blogging Heads TV legitimately believe that capitalism can be the bugs can be worked out of it with just the right amount of regulation. Sure, there won't be an elimination of all inequality, but that's not a realistic goal anyway, right? I mean, the aim is for everyone to have a decent standard of living, for instance.
Here's the thing. Who was that fucker at Mother Jones?
Oh my God, Kevin Drum.
Yeah, Kevin Drum, the cat guy. Yeah. No, he wrote this thing twirling at both us and Matt Brunig, and he concluded by saying, I'll stick with managed social democratic state, thank you very much. And it's like, even if you do believe that, if you believe the Vox conception of the world that, we can just work out the bugs. How are you going to do that? You wrote the proposal. It makes perfect sense. It's very logical, and this is going to improve our lives by 0.3%. How are you going to do it? You can't. There's absolutely nothing.
We know for a fact that approach to politics leads to defeat. It leads to the defeat at the ballot box. It leads to demobilization of your base. It leads to the ascendancy of the most psychotic reptilian boomer jackal Nazi scumbags on earth, who take over the government, create hyper inequality, destroy Earth essentially by refusing to do anything about climate change, and rig the electoral process to ensure that their white minority rule essentially is never able to be opposed. And your fucking charts and your ameliorated plans have not stopped them and can't stop them.
Right.
So you talk all day about how, this wash shows that the Obamacare system is the best way to control healthcare costs. Okay, good. Did it get you any votes? Did it prevent Republicans from taking over and dismantling everything you built? It did not. And they have no alternative to that. It is really just they're putting Humpty Dumpty back together again every goddamn time. That Joe Biden or some other fossil is going to be able to, how dare you, sir, his way into the White House. I got to tell you, unless there's a fortuitous economic collapse, but given Trump's otherworldly luck, we know that won't happen until the day he leaves office. They're going to lose. And, and even if they don't lose the White House, they're guaranteed to never take any control of legislatures at the state or national level, which renders them powerless. They will never be able to ameliorate the worst effects of capitalism. It will only be the most revanchist, psychotic, delusional Nazi libertarianism that uses the market, quote unquote, to punish the groups that are considered inferior by the people who vote for it and gain by it, and that they will never be able to be opposed by this type of politics.
I actually just worry that if there was an economic crisis, like a severe one like we had in 2008 or worse, and Trump was in office, that rather than it being the end of Trump, it would be the beginning of a real proto-fascist moment in America. But yep. But otherwise, I'm with you. The thing I'll say, though, is that I guess what they would always argue is, well, if we could just get our people in, then lives would improve. Right.
Don't
vote. Well, you have to shut up and get on the get on the magic bus.
They scold non-voters and they scold third-party voters, but that is a fundamental misapprehension of the job of a political party. A job of a political party, it is very much like a business. It's like if people are buying less Coke, the Coke executives don't go, these fucking idiots, what's wrong with them? Coke. And badger people for not drinking Coke.
I would, though. If I ran a soda company, I would absolutely.
They say, oh, we're not appealing to as many people as we were. What are we doing wrong? But and that is how a political party operates, because you don't have control over the actions of marginal voters and of third party voters. You only have control of what you put out there as a political party. So
yeah, but you know what? Here's the thing with the Coca-Cola executives, you know what they do to figure out what they're doing wrong? They turn to wonks and eggheads and spreadsheets and market research.
They change something. They change the formula or the ad campaign or something.
They do change the ad campaign, but they don't change the aim of the company.
They will never change anything.
Right. Well, I just feel like, that what you really are wanting to say is not – you don't want Coca-Cola as a model, because I think Coca-Cola is a model. Like, I think the Clinton campaign
– the structure of a political party – is the same in that you don't have control over the voters.
Right.
You only have control of what you do. And the fixation on stigmatizing and blaming and trying to shame the voters instead of changing yourself is a particular psychosis of the Democratic Party, and that no other structure on their size or influence in this country operates that way.
Right. I think that it comes down to this. If they are really on our side, they would be fighting for the same things we are. It's just like that. They actually are fighting for the things they believe in. They actually are trying to get people to join them. Their product is shit. And that's the problem. What I would still like to see, though, is for the left to be able to embrace it's part of the spirit that the right is using against us. This idea of, we ought to debate things. We got to be open to, ideas. We can't be too touchy about things or put too many taboos around ideas, because then we're going to block off the truth some of the time. That's what I do think we need to hold on to when it comes to like liberal ideology, is this idea that open communication, at least on our own side.
Yeah, well, I mean, here's the thing. That only exists on the left. Everything else is just sort of the wonkery and play acting and blogging heading.
You guys were not unhappy that a Politico writer was so cruel to your book.
No, it was delightful. The review itself was filled with just mush-headed idiocy and outright lies. And everyone who signal boosted it was a genuine ghoul or soulless hack.
Or dullard who didn't read it.
It really did. It made me feel very – I was honestly a little worried about the book. We've never done anything in this long form, and we had to compress very complicated subjects into relatively few pages. And I was worried that we might have made oversights or been too facile in a way that misrepresented history. But seeing that that's the best this chowderhead could come up with, I feel very, very happy. I think like the book is solid because, I mean, it was a pathetic – an absolutely pathetic display. The idea that fucking Jimmy Carter was not a neoliberal deregulator because he created the Department of Energy. Or Gary Hart is the last neoliberal politician in America.
Genius.
This is insanity.
They have nothing in terms of an argument or a coherent worldview or a useful praxis, but what they do have is they are speaking on behalf of a hegemonic liberalism that is going to get us all fucking killed.
They've got a lot of money.
I agree, don't talk to them, but they're a distraction from the real fucking problem, which is that fascism arises because of the collapse of institutional legitimacy of liberal institutions. And that's how we got fucking Trump. It's how we're going to get what's coming next after him that's going to be even worse. Because if you think there's not going to be more ecological and economic catastrophes in the future that liberalism is wholly unsuited to fucking deal with, and that failure is not going to lead to fascism filling that fucking hole, you got another thing coming. And that's what these guys are. These guys who marched in Charlottesville, these are the people who are aware of –